Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff. On the NewsHour tonight, the hearings continue. The committee investigating the January 6th insurrection focuses on the actions of former President Trump as the mob attacked the Capitol. Then the invasion intensifies. Russia tightens its grip on eastern Ukraine by overhauling police forces and making plans for secession referendums. And the tipping point, the millions who rely on the Colorado River for water face an uncertain future amid an unrelenting drought.
If climate change hadn't happened, the West would still be in a drought, but the severity of the drought is undoubtedly worse because of climate change.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. President Biden has tested positive for COVID for the first time. The White House announced it today and said the symptoms are very mild. The president's physician said he has a runny nose, fatigue, and a dry cough. In a video on Twitter, Mr. Biden said he's fine and keeping busy.
And I really appreciate your inquiries and your concerns. But I'm doing well, getting a lot of work done, going to continue to get it done.
Mr. Biden is 79. He is fully vaccinated and boosted and is taking the drug Paxlovid to ward off severe symptoms. COVID response coordinator Ashish Jha defended the White House pandemic protocols.
We always said that this was a possibility. I think I even said it from this stage that this was a possibility. I think that the protocols have kept him from getting infected but we knew that this was a possibility with this incredibly contagious variant.
The president will isolate at the White House until he tests negative. The January 6th committee in the U.S. Congress holds its eighth and possibly final hearing tonight. Testimony will focus on the 3 hours when then-President Trump watched the violence on television but did nothing to stop it. We'll delve into the details after this news summary. Heat indexes in the United States hit triple digits today, from the deep south to the northeast. Forecasters warn the extreme readings could continue for days. A separate heat wave moved east in Europe, sparking new wildfires in Poland and Slovenia. Crews are still battling other fires in Italy, Spain, and Portugal. Turkey has announced tonight that Russia and Ukraine will sign a deal tomorrow to resume Ukrainian grain imports through the Black Sea. So far, though, Kyiv and Moscow have not yet confirmed it. Meanwhile, Russian natural gas began flowing again through a major pipeline to Europe at reduced levels after a maintenance break. We'll return to Ukraine later in the program. The Prime Minister of Italy, Mario Draghi, resigned today when his ruling coalition fell apart after 17 months in power. Draghi was Italy's sixth prime minister in a decade. His government's collapse left many Italians frustrated as they face a long drought and a troubled economic recovery.
It really isn't the right moment for a government crisis. This should have been the moment to get back on our feet, not the moment to stop.
At such a delicate moment, I think it was a reckless move not to bear in mind everything that is happening globally with the war and the ongoing pandemic.
Later, Italy's president dissolved parliament and set new national elections for September 25th. Back in this country, New York State reported the first polio case in the U.S. since 2013. It involves an unvaccinated adult north of New York City. The strain may have been spread by someone who received a live vaccine used overseas. Polio largely disappeared from the U.S. in the 1970s. The U.S. House of Representatives voted today to protect access to contraception. Democrats argued it is essential now that the Supreme Court has erased federally protected abortion rights. Republicans charged the bill goes too far. Debate broke almost entirely down party lines.
It's unfortunate that this bill is written in such a way that it's unclear that it just covers traditional contraceptives. It is disappointing to see that my colleagues across the aisle are continuing to push their extreme abortion on demand agenda.
This is not a side issue that only affects some people. This is a kitchen table issue. The decision of how and if and when to grow a family are decisions that are personal and private and should never be decided by the Supreme Court or Congress.
Republicans in the Senate today blocked action on a similar bill. A federal judge has sentenced a former Minneapolis police officer, Thomas Lane, to 2.5 years in prison for violating George Floyd's civil rights. Lane, who is awaiting sentencing on a state manslaughter charge, held Floyd's legs while another officer fatally knelt on his neck for more than 9 minutes in 2020. Prosecutors had sought a sentence of up to 6.5 years. A major scientific group is warning that monarch butterflies are now an endangered species. The International Union for the Conservation of Nature estimates monarch numbers have dropped 22% to 72% across North America over 10 years. The decline is blamed on pesticides, climate change, and loss of habitat. And on Wall Street, technology firms led the way as stocks rose for a third straight day. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 162 points to close near 32,037. The Nasdaq also rose 162 points. That's more than 1%. And the S&P 500 gained 1% as well. Still to come on the news hour, Russia tightens its grip on eastern Ukraine by making plans for secession referendums. An unrelenting drought imperils the millions who rely on the Colorado River for water. The director of a new Disney series featuring the first Muslim superhero discusses the show's impact, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
The January 6th committee will be holding a prime time hearing this evening, the final in a series this summer of testimony alleging an organized conspiracy that led to the Capitol insurrection. The case they've laid out puts former President Trump at the center of that conspiracy. Our congressional correspondent Lisa Desjardins has been following all of this closely. And hello to you, Lisa. You've been talking to members of the committee. What should we expect tonight?
This will be, of course, as we've expected, a high-stakes and potentially high-drama hearing tonight, Judy. The theme is the 187 minutes that President Trump spent, and the committee will charge, doing nothing to stop the riot here at the U.S. Capitol. What does that mean? That's the time from when President Trump ended his speech before that Stop the Steal rally close to the White House, and then up to the time, just over 3 hours later, when he sent out a tweet asking the rioters essentially to stop. I think tonight's hearing, we're going to be seeing some graphic pictures of what was going on at the Capitol while we are hearing about the timetable, what Mr. Trump was and was not doing. I do not think it'll be family viewing. I think it's going to be an emotional night. We will also hear from two witnesses in person who were there with Mr. Trump on January 6th. That's Matthew Pottinger. He was the Deputy National Security Advisor. And also next to him, Sarah Matthews, the Deputy Press Secretary. Now, those were both two people who were sworn to serve the president, but who left because they felt, and this is what the committee will say tonight, what we may hear them say tonight, that they could no longer serve the country and serve President Trump at the same time. Also tonight, Judy, we should hear, we're told, we'll hear more about communications involving members of Congress.
And, of course, PBS will be carrying these hearings live. So, Lisa, there has been a poll the NewsHour has been part of. What are we learning from that poll about how Americans are seeing the evidence that the committee's been building up in these hearings?
So important while we pay attention to lawmakers here to figure out what is the country getting from all of this. We asked the question, should President Trump be charged with a crime, which is sort of a central part of the hearings here? And as you see, the country is split, but leaning toward 50% say yes, he should be charged with crimes. We also asked, will the former president be charged with crimes? Look at that. A huge difference. There you see almost two-thirds of the people answering our survey said no, they do not believe in the end, though they think he should, that President Trump will be charged. You see a lot in that data, including some mistrust of institutions and how they will carry out this situation. We also sort of a different question, not about crimes or what President Trump will happen to him in the future, but do people personally blame former President Trump for what happened on January 6th. Here's what we got in this survey right now. 57% said, yes, he is to blame for the events of January 6th. Look at what we found just after January 6th, there in January of 2021. Those figures, very similar. In fact, a little bit less of a view that the president is to blame. It's interesting because, of course, we know that people are watching these hearings, Judy, but this tells us that as far as people wanting to cast a finger of blame at the president, they're about where they were right after January 6th.
Really, really interesting. And Lisa, what are we seeing from these polls about whether Americans are watching the hearings or not, and how that breaks down along partisan lines?
Yeah, you know, I think when you talk to the committee, they believe the viewership is strong, stronger than even they expected. But how many people are watching? Who is watching? We ask that question. So if we ask people if they're paying at least some or a lot of attention to the January 6th hearings, you look, it's a breakdown by party. No surprise, 80% of people who identify as Democrats say yes, they are watching. Independents, more than half. Republicans, the smallest number, but still 44% of Republicans. And we know, in general, there's a partisan split on whether they blame President Trump, whether they think he should be charged. But 44% of Republicans, nonetheless, are still watching these hearings. And we also asked them, so what do people think happened on January 6th? What are their views right now after these hearings have been going forward? First, we asked, who thinks it's an insurrection? About 50% of people now said they do believe it was an insurrection. That's about where it was just last year before these hearings started. But look what has changed a little bit. Those who said protected political speech is what happened on January 6th, that number's gone down. Fewer people believe that, and more people believe that it was unfortunate, but in the past. What I take from that, Judy, is that more people are less willing to defend what happened on January 6th, and more people just want it to go away. One quick number also, though, is this an issue in November? We asked that. Is January 6th, what's happening here, a top issue for you? There you see, for most Americans, it's not. Democrats say the most. What's at the top of the issue list? I don't think our viewers will be surprised that at the top of the issue list for everyone is inflation. Democrats also, top of their list, abortion. But the January 6th hearings, not getting more than 17%, and that's just among Democrats.
So meantime, Lisa, you've also been watching what's been going on with efforts to fix, if you will, the Electoral Reform Act. We know that was a factor in what happened on January 6th. What is going on there? Where does that stand?
So much to say. The Electoral Count Act, there was a bipartisan bill introduced in the Senate. We've been telling you about it, and now it is real. Let me go through what this would do. It would make governors across the country be the conclusive deciders in certifying electors. The law right now is less clear than that. It would say that disputes from any candidates would have to go to a panel of judges. That would be new. It would narrow when Congress can object, under what circumstances, and it would require a one-fifth vote of each chamber to advance objections. Judy, as you well know, right now it just takes one member from each chamber, incredibly low bar. This would make it harder to object, and it puts up more guardrails to prevent the questions and motivations that we saw at play on January 6th. We'll watch where this goes. It looks like it has a lot of support. We'll be keeping you updated on it.
Yeah, so interesting, and we know you're going to continue to keep an eye on it. Lisa Desjardins, we'll see you tonight. For more on the upcoming hearing, we turn to a member of the January 6th Select Committee. Congresswoman Elaine Luria of Virginia is co-leading the presentation tonight, and she joins me now from the Capitol. Congresswoman Luria, thank you so much for being here. The committee is saying that tonight we're going to learn more about what former President Trump did and did not do on January 6th. What new will we learn tonight?
Well, we're going to paint a very clear picture, a minute by minute almost, detailed picture of what happened between the time he stepped off the stage at the Ellipse. And as a reminder, he had just given a speech, a rallying cry to this mob that he had assembled in Washington. And he led them to believe that he was going to join them in marching to the Capitol. And then he went back to the White House. He really still wanted to go to the Capitol, but went back to the White House. And we'll see over the course of 187 minutes, that's more than 3 hours, that he sat in the White House and watched the events unfold. Many people around him, there was a flurry of action and pressure, essentially, to try to get him to stand up and use the microphone that he had as the president of the United States to tell the rioters to stop the violence. But he didn't do that until about 4:17 in the afternoon, when, you know, it was clear that what the rioters were trying to do to pressure the vice president to stop or delay the counting of the election results, that wasn't going to be successful. So we'll go into a lot of detail, and we'll hear from lots of people who were in the White House that day.
Do you know for a fact that former President Trump could have stopped the rioters from that attack, could have called it off?
Well, what I'll tell you, and we heard from Mr. Ayers last week as a witness, and, you know, he said when he got a message from the president, essentially that 4:17 speech, which it was not a very forceful message to stop, people watched and they listened. And he said he himself and other people he was there with, who they'd been called here by Trump, President Trump said, you know, go home in peace. He also gave, you know, a rather disconcerting message of love and commiseration with them. But they said, it's time to go and leave. So the president, you know, the Oval Office is very close to a camera that's live 24/7. As the president of the United States, he has the opportunity to stand up with a microphone to the nation and tell not only the people at the Capitol, but the whole country that the violence was unacceptable.
As you mentioned, it does appear the president, the former president, wanted to go to the Capitol, couldn't do that. You've been trying to get those text messages between secret members of the Secret Service on that day. They've said that they were in the process of changing over to a new system. They've all been wiped. Do you think you're going to get them or any significant portion of them?
That's yet to be determined. This is something that is of great interest to the committee. We issued a subpoena with a quick turnaround time frame to ask the Secret Service to provide us that information. And we're going to continue to try to get to the bottom of this. I mean, at least to me, it's not satisfying for them to just say, you know, we can't locate them. You know, there are a lot of technical experts out there, you know, who are able to relocate data. And we will continue to pursue this.
I want to ask you about a poll that the NewsHour did in coordination with NPR and Marist College. Congresswoman, we asked, this was just a few days ago, we asked Americans their views of what happened on January 6th, and we found that since last December, views have barely changed. Half of Americans then and now believe, yes, there was an insurrection, while the other half believes it was just a political protest at worst or just an unfortunate thing that happened and it's time to move on. What does it say to you that after all the work that this committee's put in and after all these hearings that people, that the numbers really haven't moved at all on the part of the public's perception of January 6th?
I can speak anecdotally to those conversations that I have with people across my district when I'm out and about talking to constituents. You know, they tell me, they said, you know, I knew it was bad, but I didn't quite understand how all of the pieces fit together. So I've heard over and over again for people who've been, you know, watching the work of the committee that this has made them, you know, understand more clearly, brought all of the pieces into focus about how this was a deliberate multi-step plan to apply pressure on the vice president, fake electors, assembling the mob, and then today we'll talk about the actual events of the day of January 6th. So I hope that anyone out there watching who has, you know, any doubt or question in their mind, that they'll listen and hear the facts.
One of the other questions we asked, Congresswoman, is whether people believe former President Trump should be charged with a crime. 50% said yes, he should be, but only 28% said he will. Do they believe he will be? What do you believe? Do you think? Do you think he will be charged ultimately?
Well, you know, again, there's a separation between the congressional committee you know, that's conducting this investigation and presenting the facts here and the Department of Justice. The committee is forward-looking, so we're really, our purpose is to lay out the facts and provide recommendations for the future to prevent something like this. The Department of Justice, you know, is essentially backward-looking in the sense they're the ones who have to determine if a crime was committed and hold someone accountable for those actions. I know that the Department of Justice is conducting investigations. It's the largest investigation that they've criminal investigation ever with over 800 defendants. But I don't have, you know, exact knowledge of where that investigation is progressing. It's gone from individuals, you know, who were located at the Capitol that trespass, violence, you know, different crimes like that, to a level of seditious conspiracy, which is a very serious crime, very rarely, you know, prosecuted within our country. And so I see that they're you know, ratcheting up their efforts. Would I like them to go more quickly so that we can understand where this will ultimately go? Yes, but I do understand the magnitude of it. And I know that they're listening to the work of the committee as well. Judges who've made rulings recently with regards to January 6th defendants have actually used information that we've presented as a committee in those findings.
Representative Elaine Luria, who will be co-leading the questioning tonight. Congresswoman, thank you. Tonight we'll be watching.
Thank you.
And for more of a preview of tonight's events, I'm joined now by Carol Lenig. She is an investigative reporter at The Washington Post. And Jamil Jaffer, he's a law professor at George Mason University and former associate counsel to President George W. Bush. Welcome to both of you. Carol Lenig, to you first. What in particular are you going to be watching for tonight, especially when it comes to the two witnesses we expect?
Yes, that's right, Judy. The two witnesses we know will testify are two people who really were rooting for Donald Trump's presidency, who served it from almost the start, and who followed him into that White House because they hoped to help accomplish some of the conservative agenda items that he had been pushing and promising to his supporters. That includes National Security Deputy Advisor Matt Pottinger at the time and an aide named Sarah Matthews. Both of them will testify that despite their desire to see Donald Trump succeed, to serve his administration, the way he teed up a near coup, the way he enabled an attack on the Capitol and did not call off his supporters when the vice president's life and other lawmakers' lives were in danger, was the final straw for them. It broke their, it was a breach they could not endure. And both of them resigned within hours of those events. That is not new. I'll emphasize to you, Judy, that's not new. We know that about both of them. But what's important about their testimony is, once again, the committee is focusing on what Republicans have to say and what Trump's own former cheerleaders and aides feel about what happened that day.
And Jamil Jaffer, that's exactly what I wanted to ask you. What is the significance of hearing from these two individuals? We've been hearing from Republicans, from people in the White House who are working for President Trump. We're going to see that again tonight. Why does that matter?
Well, you know, Judy, the main point here is that what the president did, his behavior and his actions that day contributed to what happened at the Capitol, as we know from his speech on the Ellipse and the like, but they allowed the process to continue. His inaction for that 187 minutes as he sat in the White House watching what was happening on television, as his aides clamored, Kim coming to him saying, Mr. President, people are going to die. The Capitol's under attack. You have to say something. And his decision to not act for that lengthy period is what's at the heart of what happened on that day. And that's intolerable for many Republicans. It was intolerable for Matt Pottinger and Sarah Matthews, who quit the day that happened. It was intolerable for a number of members of cabinet, including his education secretary and the like, his labor secretary, who quit on that day or in the immediate days afterwards. And it should be intolerable for all Republicans, including Republicans in the House, who on that day and the day after, like Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy, said it was intolerable, said it was unacceptable, and since then have backed off and backpedaled in ways that are hard to imagine.
And in fact, in connection with that, Carol Lenig, you were telling us what you are looking to see tonight is what you call the split screen, where on the one hand, we will see what the former president was doing at the very same moment mayhem, violence was unfolding at the Capitol.
That's right, Judy. And I think the Congresswoman hints at that a little bit. You will see timestamps, I believe, where, you know, this is when the Capitol was breached. Listen as, for example, one voice you can hear, I think, tonight will be Capitol Police Chief Sund, essentially begging for reinforcements, reporting that there is a riot unfolding on the Capitol, declaring a riot, saying in fairly strident tones, I need backup. We now have people breaching the Capitol's windows and doors. And at the same time, on the other side of that split screen, Judy, you'll see the president watching the television, watching the live coverage from various newscasts, and being, if not gleeful, close to gleeful, that his supporters had done exactly what he asked them to do. You'll see timestamps, I believe, where people are reading Donald Trump's, a specific individual, a rioter on the campus of the Capitol, is reading Donald Trump's text in which he calls, basically puts a target on Vice President Pence's back and says that he didn't have the courage. That's at 2:34, if memory serves. The Capitol has been breached. People are running through the hallways, and they are talking and chanting about hanging Mike Pence at that point. The overlap will, I think, be pretty startling. I think you'll see on the other side Donald Trump describing in the aftermath, what did he want to happen? What did he hope to accomplish on January 6th? And then you'll see the view of what was wrought, what his wishes wrought.
And Jamil Jaffer, I mean, just for purposes of contrast, comparison, you're a student of history as well as being a lawyer. Are there any other examples you can think of presidents who have essentially laid back while the American democracy was under assault?
No, I can't, to be honest with you, Judy. And to the contrary, when American democracy, the heart of our union, has been challenged, American presidents like Abraham Lincoln have stepped up and done what it takes to respond to that and keep the union together. At times, presidents like Abraham Lincoln took extreme actions. Donald Trump did exactly the opposite. He stood by, watched, let it happen, and no amount of excusing that and saying, well, it was just a small protest or it got a little out of hand or whatever. We all saw what our eyes saw. Nobody can tell us what we didn't see, what we saw on television. And the fact of the matter is the president was watching it live in action as it happened. And, you know, saying to his aides, who were saying to him, Mr. President, you must do something, you know, and we heard what his chief of staff and the White House counsel talked about. His chief of staff said, look, Pat, to the White House counsel, the president doesn't want to do anything. He thinks Mike deserves it. The vice president deserves the chance of hanging Mike Pence. I mean, it's unimaginable that any president would say that about the vice president, much less as the Capitol is being attacked and he's tweeting about Mike Pence not having the courage he needs to have. It's hard to imagine that happening. If we hadn't all watched it happen, I'd think you were telling me about a bad movie.
And just quickly, Carol Lenig, you reminded us today when you interviewed former President Trump for your book, and you asked him what he wanted to happen that day, what he said to you.
You know, for our book, I Alone Can Fix It, my colleague and I, Phil Rucker, sat down with the president for nearly 3 hours in Mar-a-Lago, about 2 months after the attack on the Capitol. And one of my number one goals was to find out, what did he want? And what he said was, I wanted what my supporters wanted. I wanted what they wanted to happen. And I think, you know, it's clear from all sorts of television newscasts, live video, streaming, the traffic on the radios of the law enforcement, it's clear what those individuals wanted. And that was either to kill Mike Pence, kill Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, kidnap them, and in other ways, by violence, to stop the certification of the proper election of Joe Biden and to block the peaceful transfer of power.
Still startling just to think of it. Carol Lenig, Jamil Jaffer, we thank you both. We appreciate it.
Judy.
And please tune in to PBS Tonight for our special coverage of the House Select Committee public hearing on January 6th. That is at 8 p.m. Eastern. Officials from Turkey and the United Nations say they expect to sign a deal with Russia and Ukraine tomorrow to allow Ukraine to resume vital exports. The country is one of the world's largest providers of grain and oil. Meanwhile, the battles grind on. Russia this week said that its goals had expanded to the country's south and southeast as the war of attrition continues in the eastern Donbass. Nick Schifrin reports.
Where children once played, today, soldiers and police dug through the obliterated remains of a school where children once learned, the latest Russian attempt to erase Ukraine's future, an entire generation shattered by war.
I graduated from this school 2 years ago. I cannot believe this is the reality we live in.
Residents of Kramatorsk are shell-shocked. They know they are now the front lines. Missiles destroyed Yevhen Harbakh and his wife's home while they were inside.
I could not believe it when we were under the rubble. After all, one wants to live. So we dug ourselves out with these hands. What else was there to do?
Kramatorsk is in the Donetsk region that Russian forces are now trying to seize after capturing virtually all of the Luhansk region. The two regions make up the Donbass. But yesterday, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Moscow's goals go beyond that.
Now the geography is different. This is not only the Luhansk People's Republic and the Donetsk People's Republic. This is also the Kherson region and the Zaporizhia region and a number of other territories.
Parts of Zaporizhia and Kherson regions have been captured and occupied by Russia since the February invasion. National Security Council Communications Coordinator John Kirby said Russia intends to make those gains permanent.
We're seeing ample evidence in the intelligence and in the public domain that Russia intends to try to annex additional Ukrainian territory. Russia is beginning to roll out a version of what you could call an annexation playbook. 33!
To try and prevent that, the West has sent billions of dollars worth of weapons. The most advanced, the U.S. High Mobility Advanced Rocket Systems, or HIMARS. Senior U.S. officials say Ukraine is using them against high-value Russian targets, including command posts and a bridge in occupied Ukraine that Russia uses to supply its military. The U.S. has sent 16, but limited the ammunition range to 40 miles. Ukrainian Minister of Defense Alexei Reznikov said this week there aren't enough.
For an effective counteroffensive, we would need at least 100, I think. That could become a game changer on the battlefield.
The Ukrainian strategy is to force Russians to pay a high price to achieve little progress, says Joint Chiefs Chairman General Mark Milley.
Is the Donbass lost? No, it's not lost yet. The Ukrainians are making the Russians pay for every inch of territory that they gain.
But in every inch of land, there are thousands of civilian lives. Families continue to leave the front lines on trains headed west. Mothers whose children may never see their homes again.
To abandon your house is the worst thing ever. We abandoned our life there. I feel empty. How are we going to keep on living?
For more on this, we turn to Andrew Weiss. He served in the George H.W. Bush and Clinton administrations at the Pentagon, National Security Council staff, and the State Department. He's now Vice President for Studies at Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, a think tank. Andrew Weiss, welcome back to the NewsHour. Let's start with that announcement, a possible deal that would allow Ukraine to once again export food out of what has been the blockaded port of Odessa. Remind us, what has been preventing Ukraine from exporting food?
So the Russian government is trying to strangle Ukraine's economy. And one of the key exports of the Ukrainian economy is grain, which it sells primarily to countries in places like sub-Saharan Africa and the Middle East. So the impact on global food insecurity from these blockades of Ukrainian ports has been quite significant. And the Russians have also bombed port facilities and grain storage facilities in southern Ukraine. So the question is, have the Russians suddenly had a change of heart where they no longer want to destroy Ukraine's economy and its ability to feed the world? I'm going to remain somewhat skeptical about that. This is an extremely delicate stage, obviously, for the final moments before this announcement tomorrow. We'll see what the actual agreement it consists of. But it does require a certain suspension of disbelief that suddenly the Russian government is negotiating in good faith.
If the agreement is signed tomorrow, though, how significant is that?
We'll see the implementation. So Russia has been a master in these kinds of conflict situations of saying it's going to do the right thing and then proceeding to do the exact opposite. There are so many complex issues bound up with opening up the ports. Namely, can you find commercial shipping operators that are going to put themselves at risk and send their crews into an area that's heavily mined? As well as the question of, will the Ukrainians be willing to remove mines that they've put in place to try to protect, for example, the port of Odessa from a possible Russian invasion?
Let's shift back to the question of Russian war aims. How significant is it that Russia is now out loud saying that its aims go beyond the eastern Donbass region and include the Kherson and Zaporizhia regions?
Russia's foreign minister has now indicated that because the West has come to Ukraine's rescue and provided significant military assistance, Russia now needs to seize even more territory and basically annex parts of Ukraine itself, Ukraine proper, that were not part of the source of war and tension in the 2014-2015 period. So Russia has now basically tried to excuse what it's about to do, which is carve up the territory of a neighboring country and blame it on the West. This is classic Russian blame shifting. But annexation, if it happens, is a major escalatory move.
We heard John Kirby earlier in the segment use the words annexation playbook. What are we likely to see Russia actually do?
So the Russian government right now is preparing for regional elections in regular parts of Russia, and those elections are set for September 11th. The question is, can you dress up what's happening in these regions? The Donbas region consists of two oblasts, Donetsk Oblast and Luhansk Oblast, as well as what's happening in nearby Kherson and Zaporizhia Oblast. Can you come up with enough of a stable environment where Russia can conduct a referendum? They did that in 2014 in Crimea, but that was not a war zone. What's going on in southern Ukraine, which would be this land bridge that Russia has wanted for a long time to connect Mother Russia to Crimea, as well as what's been going on in Donbas, is a very heavily fought over, very dangerous area. So the idea that you're going to have voter turnout, that you're going to have kind of a cooperative local populace that wants to participate in this kind of stuff is to me a big stretch. But for whatever reason, I think this comes back to the sort of lunacy of this war in the first place. Vladimir Putin seems to want some shred of legitimacy for what he's doing. And he thinks that if he has a staged vote, that that will be enough. It may please North Korea, but I doubt it'll please anybody else.
Is there anything you believe the administration can be doing to try and prevent annexations? Ukraine, of course, is asking for a lot more long-range artillery.
Yeah, so I think the administration every day is looking at what they can do to help the Ukrainian government be effective on the battlefield. We've also seen the beginnings of insurgency-type actions in areas where the Russians are dominant, like in Kherson Oblast. So I think you're likely to see the administration giving Ukraine's government and the people of Ukraine the tools they need and the support they need to defend themselves against this invasion. The problem is that both sides are in a war of attrition, as Secretary Austin and Joint Chiefs Chairman General Milley indicated the other day. This is a grueling, long-term battle. And I think there's been a notion circulating in the world that somehow both sides are going to get exhausted. And then based on that, there'll be a pause. I mean, there may be pauses, but that doesn't mean this conflict is close to resolution. We're nowhere near that point.
Andrew Weiss, thank you very much.
Great to be with you.
The heat wave gripping much of the country is also compounding the impact of a mega drought out west that has lasted the better part of two decades. The drought is jeopardizing the future of the Colorado River, a critical source of water for the western states, and it's spurring more questions over how the river is used while threatening long-standing agreements between states. Here's a second look at Miles O'Brien's report about the danger for this resource. It's part of our coverage of how climate change is creating a tipping point for the U.S. and the world.
This is where the shortage meets the soil. Pinal County, Arizona. Desert farmland between Phoenix and Tucson. Lifelong home for farmer Nancy Kaywood.
My family has been farming in this area for 91 years. My grandfather bought this farm, 255 acres.
They grow alfalfa and cotton, both thirsty crops, which are not doing well right now.
This is the drought in action right here. I have never seen it this bad before.
Much of her water comes from canals that are filled by the Gila River, a tributary of the Colorado River. But in April of 2021, the water stopped flowing.
We don't know when we'll see water in here again.
Same goes for farmers in Pinal County who draw water directly from the Colorado River. When the U.S. government declared an official shortage for the river in August, farmers who depend on it were also drastically cut back. Almost 1,500 miles long, the Colorado winds its way through seven states and into Mexico. This river basin is filled with lush natural ecosystems. It transforms about 5.5 million acres of barren desert into fertile farmland. 40 million people are sustained by this water. It is one of the most heavily utilized rivers in the world, and it starts here as a deep blanket of snow high in the Rocky Mountains of Wyoming, Utah, and Colorado. Hydrologist Ben Livna is an assistant professor at the University of Colorado Boulder.
Most of the water in the Colorado River starts as snowpack. And one of the reasons is that mountains act as these big catchments of precipitation.
But around the year 2000, a drought took hold and has not let go. This means less snow on those peaks in the Rockies year after year, and thus a steady reduction of water to feed the river. The two largest reservoirs in the river basin, Lake Mead and Lake Powell, are now at all-time low levels. Climatologist Park Williams is an associate professor at UCLA. He uses tree rings to study the ancient climate.
The 2000s drought in the Colorado River Basin and across the western United States has been as dry as any other 22-year period in the last millennium. The drought that we're in today is not going to last forever. It will break at some point when we have a string of really good luck years.
But the climate emergency has changed the odds. The global temperature is about 2 degrees Fahrenheit higher than it was before the Industrial Revolution.
If climate change hadn't happened, the West would still be in a drought, but the severity of the drought is undoubtedly worse because of climate change.
Here's why. Warmer temperatures mean drier air. As the snowpack shrinks, it sheds water vapor into the atmosphere. A larger amount of snow melts into liquid water and rapidly evaporates in this warmer climate. Now the soil is drier than usual.
This causes the soils to act like a very dry sponge. And the next precipitation event that occurs on top of that dry sponge is going to work to refilling the soil sponge as opposed to refilling our rivers and reservoirs.
This precious resource is allocated based on a 1922 agreement called the Colorado River Compact. Once the river basin states agreed on their fair shares, they each established a seniority system, first in time, first in right.
There's kind of a hierarchy of water rights. That means that people who gained access to the river first, they have what we would call a senior water right.
Colorado River water first came to Pinal County in the mid-1980s upon completion of the Central Arizona Project, a network of canals that spans 300 miles across the desert. It puts farmers here at the bottom of the seniority list, making them the first to go dry in the midst of this mega drought.
So over the years, we've had to adapt to whatever we can make money at, basically. So on this farm, it's really close to a bunch of dairies, and they need a bunch of feed.
Will Thielander is a third-generation farmer in Casa Grande. He and his family are part of an experiment in using their dwindling allocation of water on crops that demand less of it.
Here's the Waiuli field. So you can see it's in a nice bloom. And this crop hasn't been watered for about 2 weeks.
They have planted a 40-acre tract of Waiuli, a plant that thrives in the desert and contains a milky latex that can be used to formulate rubber. An acre can produce enough to make 50 tires. Bridgestone is working out the production kinks at this pilot plant, while Thielander does the same at this pilot plot.
With this crop using half as much water as the corn, our water will last twice as long here. So that's why the crop is so promising. We really hope it takes off.
But for Nancy Kaywood, the story is different. She can't afford the cost of the new equipment required to harvest crops that need less water. She says she can hold on to the family farm for a year, but
eventually the money runs out. You can't pay the water and the taxes anymore, so it's not your best interest to try to keep the land. Your best interest is to probably go ahead and sell. And it's heart-wrenching to think that, but it's true.
It would be the end of an era here, and maybe the beginning of a new one. Her neighbors recently sold their land, and it's now a solar farm. Kaywood has been approached by an energy company as well. There is little to suggest this trend will reverse anytime soon. For years, humans overspent the Colorado River, and nature covered the overdrafts. But now the climate emergency has ensured the bill has come due. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Miles O'Brien in Phoenix.
A new Disney Plus series features the first Muslim superhero in the Marvel Cinematic Universe and is now one of the highest-rated shows of its kind. Amna Nawaz talks to the director about bringing this character to life. It's part of our arts and culture series, Canvas.
What does it feel like?
Cosmic.
It's the origin story of Kamala Khan, a 16-year-old Pakistani-American living in New Jersey and Marvel's newest superhero. The six-part series, now streaming on Disney Plus, follows Khan, a Marvel Comics-obsessed teen and superfan of Captain Marvel, who suddenly finds herself thrust into the superhero ranks when an ancient family heirloom grants Khan her own superpowers.
I'm a superhero.
But Ms. Marvel brings something new to the Marvel Cinematic Universe, or MCU as it's known. The series is based on Marvel's first Muslim lead character and weaves Kamala Khan's culture throughout, with Pakistani music, food, and dialogue in Urdu. I spoke with one of the directors of the show, Sharmeen Obaid Chinoy, on representing both hero and heritage in Ms. Marvel.
If you had told me that this story would be told 20 years ago, when I was growing up, I would have laughed at it. But my daughters are going to have a superhero that looks like them, that argues about curfew just the way they do, or that argue about what they should be wearing. What Ms. Marvel does is it takes audiences into our world, lets them in into our secret, that we have this beautiful, colorful, incredible culture.
Pakistani-Canadian Obaid Chinoy burst onto the world stage in 2012, winning an Oscar for her documentary Saving Face on acid attacks against women in Pakistan. She won again in 2016 for A Girl in the River, about honor killings.
How does a director go from Academy Award-winning documentaries to a live-action superhero teen series? What is it that drew you to this project?
I've always filmed men and women around the world who are extraordinary, who are creating change in their communities, working on climate change or health or education. They are superheroes. And so when Ms. Marvel came around, I thought about what she would mean to millions of people around the world who would see a reflection of themselves in her. And I knew immediately that she was in the same vein as the kind of projects that I've always been doing.
The heart and face of the show, Pakistani-Canadian actress Iman Vellani as Kamala Khan.
I really hope that the show can do for other people what the comics did for me.
Iman Vellani is actually Kamala Khan because she is a Pakistani-Canadian who grew up as a first-generation immigrant. And, she is just this incredible actress. And she sort of just eased into that role.
Oh, my God.
In the filming of the series, Iman connected with her own culture.
In the final two episodes of the series, Khan finds herself in Karachi, Pakistan, Obaid Chinoy's hometown.
You know, we often see Pakistan in Hollywood through this yellow filter. It's like the entire country is jaundice. In my episode, she goes on this chase through the streets of Karachi where you have trucks and buses and things happening. In the chaos of her chase is the beauty of Pakistan that I wanted to bring onto screen.
About the bangles.
That bangle belonged to my mother, Aisha.
The one who disappeared during partition, my great-grandmother, Aisha.
There is a history lesson embedded in the magic. Khan finds herself time-traveling to 1947 partition, the division of India and Pakistan that led to one of the largest and deadliest mass migrations in world history.
Tell me why you decided to go into that in the detail you did.
It isn't something that people talk about very much, and it's definitely never visualized in Hollywood. You know, I didn't want to sanitize the history, that moment. It might be part of a superhero story, but these kinds of stories are very real. Many families lost each other in the move. Many people were killed in the move. And so that had to be kept alive. The ethos of 1947 had to be kept alive.
Today, Kamala Khan is breaking ground and taking up space in a world that's long sidelined and silenced voices like hers. A report last year from the University of Southern California's Annenberg Inclusion Initiative looked at the 200 top-grossing films between 2017 and 2019. 90.5% didn't feature any Muslims in speaking roles. Among those that had any Muslim characters, less than a quarter were women. The representation on screen, Obaid Chinoy says, is rooted in the team off camera, like executive producer Sana Amanat, lead writer Bisha K. Ali, and their teams.
I remember walking on set and thinking that what I am experiencing is truly historic, where not only is there representation of people from around the world who are helping to tell the Kamala Khan story, but there is also representation in terms of the number of women who are in decision-making seats. In the Miss Marvel story, you can see it on screen, that it has been told with a lot of love, with a lot of authenticity.
And that story is resonating. Miss Marvel now boasts a 98% score on Rotten Tomatoes, the highest rated Disney Plus original series ever, and the highest rated Marvel series in history. Though critical acclaim is high, some audiences are just now catching up.
There were some early reports that viewership, at least initial viewership, lagged some of these other big series launches. And I wonder why you think that is.
We're used to seeing superheroes who are white and who are men. We're not used to seeing brown, women, immigrant superheroes. And I think that audiences were slow to accept it. I think the idea of Miss Marvel doesn't sit well with a lot of people. But I will also say that it is changing because as more and more people watch it and word spreads, even if it's out of curiosity, the naysayers are watching it. And there are elements of it that are resonating with them. Because at the heart of it all, it is the story of one family and their struggles and their love and their celebrations. Change comes slowly, it never comes easily.
Kamala Khan has now firmly found her place in the superhero world. Audiences will see her next in the feature film, The Marvels, coming in 2023. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Amna Nawaz.
Love that, and it is about time. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. We'll be back soon with live coverage at the January 6th hearing. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening for all of us at the PBS NewsHour. Thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.